Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The Dow Jones topped 40,000 points for the first time, while meme stocks had a bumpy ride. Ross takes a look at gold, silver, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Veteran trader Victor Adair gives us his take on whether the Fed is going to lower interest rates later this year, even though inflation is still above its stated target. It feels we're in a time that's positive for metals, including gold, silver, and copper. Author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble, John Rubino, answers the question, are we in for higher for longer until something breaks? He believes Japan might be in a death spiral due to its monetary policies and that silver may be headed for a major shortage. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the markets the past week?
Oh, kind of a giddy marketplace. I think just about everything out there is green as we finish off the week, maybe except the bond market, but it had an exceptionally good move here in the last couple of weeks. You know, here we are, all-time highs in the equity markets. The Dow's through 40,000. You know, everybody gets excited as you go through a round number, but the fact is that trend is up, and support was pretty good here 5-6 weeks ago. Upside targets for us, I'm still looking at the weekly chart in the S&P, got a Bollinger Band resistance on that's still a good 100 points above here. The S&P's at 5,300 and change, 5,400 is where that Bollinger sits, and it's also the long-term rising channel line going back to the 1920s, so 100 years of upward movement. Could become excessive here as we get pushed towards 5,400. So markets are strong, and, you know, we've been going through rotation. The utilities have been doing exceptionally well, and it's just pretty much across the board. And if you take a look at the areas like the precious metals, well, I guess the meme stocks, AMC and GameStop, just the big items of the week. Yeah, a week ago, you know, GME was at $17.50. Midweek, it was at $65, and it finished off this week at $28. So, you know, when they decide to put a squeeze on these stocks that have been out of favor for months and months and months, the short covering just causes some exceptional moves. Now, we don't typically track these, but when I go back and put my models on those charts, you know, there were some really good oversold readings at the bottom and just fabulous sells at the top of the market in the middle of this week. So big squeezes. And, you know, when I look along and think back, the last time we had one of these moves in these meme stock was back in the summer of 2020, and then had another one into the a little later in the year. But, you know, of note, everything seems to move in unison these days. You've got the squeeze happening on those. You got the move in uranium stocks, the copper stocks, the precious metals, everything here moving up. And it's with a reasonably stable U.S. dollar. The dollar index has been going really nowhere for the last couple of weeks, pretty tight trading range. So money's just been looking for new places to step out of the cash and into any viable products.
What's going on with gold?
Well, the gold and silver markets had just a very good week. Gold up over $30 at the end of the week on Friday, through $2,400, first time ever in terms of U.S. dollars. Silver up over a dollar, dollar and a half on the day on Friday. Trading now, as far as the silver is concerned, through 31 for the first time in a number of years. And when we take a look at the patterns here, the long consolidation that we've had for three and a half years in both of those markets, good breakouts here back in March, April. And for silver, the pullback to 26 was just a nice test of its breakout. And then pushing to 31 and a half as of today. The when we take a look at the depth of the consolidation that we had, this is the fifth breakout of this type of consolidation since the market bottomed in 2000. So you know, over what, 24 years worth of basic uptrends in silver with some big corrections along the way, but this is the fifth style breakout like that happened in April. Measurements for this run appear to be up around $38. So, you know, typically in the silver market, the best part of the move happens in the last 10% of the time. And we've gone into that vertical phase right now. You know, it's interesting timing. The meme stocks, GameStop being the prime example, the last time it had its big move, as it started to falter, the silver market came to life and attempted to do a big squeeze on the upside. Now, that squeeze failed. It didn't rally for too long. There was about a week or so. It was a pretty good run, though, from 24 and change up to 30. This time, it looks as though we got the same type of thing as the money's moving from one of the hottest items to another item that could potentially be a squeeze in silver. The momentum is building there. So maybe something around 38 is viable in the very near term as far as silver is concerned. The gold market, more of a methodical move. And, you know, once you're in an uptrend in the gold market, you know, you think back to the 1976 to 1980 rally or the rally into 2020, good methodical moves there. As long as the corrections manage to hold support on the way up, you just let it make its run. And, you know, the gold targets we've got out of the big consolidation pattern still would say that once we clear through this 2450, 2460 range, the next big targets on the upside are over 3,000. I don't have any time windows for that, but clearly there's a huge potential still on the upside in the gold market.
What's going on with crude oil?
Crude had a decent week here, to finishing off back just shy of $80 with $79.58 on the week. A little oversold when it got down to 76 and change in the mid part of the week. Probably good for a bounce here into the low 80s. But overall, it was a pretty good high there at 87 back in April. And the correction onto the downside, I don't think it's run its course yet. Probably gets another move down into the 70s once again as we push into the summer.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, as I say, the dollar index closed 104.5. It's come off its highs 106.5 about 2.5 weeks ago, getting close to a support range. But you know, the last 3 or 4 days, just not a lot of action in terms of that one. Take a look at the Canadian dollar, same type of move there. As far as you know, minor price action, we're at 73.5. The you know, point that we made here a few weeks ago is that it held up very well during April, early May, when the CRB index was rolling over and the oil market was breaking down. The Canadian was putting in marginally higher lows, so that's supportive for the dollar. And this week, even though these other markets didn't have much on the upside, the Canadian was not giving up ground. So until we see the dollar put on, you know, a decent rally and get overbought here, or show some divergences against the commodities, it looks as though it's got a bit of buoyancy for a while.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Victor Adair next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia, but he's still very active in the markets. His website, victoradair.ca. He's speaking to us from beautiful Parksville on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Victor, for the past several years, it seems the most crucial question in the markets has been, what's the Fed going to do? Is that still the case? And if so, what will the Fed do?
Well, that's a good way to start. Yes, the Fed, whatever the Fed was going to do, has been just incredibly important. And I was reflecting the other day with a fellow I knew from years ago that back in the day, before we had cell phones and the internet and all that kind of thing, everybody gather around the Reuters printing machine at Thursday afternoon to see what the money supply was going to be. I found out the other day they don't even report that anymore. But wow. At that point in time, you know, everybody cared. And for a while there, the monthly trade figures were critically important. And now nobody knows even what date they come out on and all that. But yes, for the past several years, the most important question, or crucial question, I guess is what you said, has been, what's the Fed going to do? Because they've been so powerful. But ready, to cut right to the chase, I've been writing in my blog here for the last couple of weeks that I think there was a change in the market's attitude to that question in the middle of April. And up until the middle of April, and let's say beginning, I don't know, last fall sometime, thereabouts, well, let's say maybe at Christmas time, the thought has been that the Fed was going to stay higher for longer. And the reason for that was, you know, inflation was sticky, whatever, and that's kind of a funny word for staying higher than people wished it would for longer than they hoped it would. So that if the Fed couldn't get inflation to come down, and that seemed to be, you know, everything they say, their primary order of business, then they would just have to keep rates up until, you know, inflation finally waved the white flag and came down. I think going back into the middle of April, that at that time the Fed once again signaled that they expect their next move would be to cut rates, even if they have to keep rates where they are for a while longer than they'd figured, they would not be raising rates. So I think the market, and I think I've used this expression with you before, would treat the Fed cutting rates as a green light special to buy stocks and, you know, whatever else is not nailed down. So right now, I think the market has been on the theme that, okay, the Fed's as tough as they're going to be, and their next step is going to be easier, so away we go. And what that has meant in the markets is bond prices have gone up, stock prices have gone up, and the U.S. dollar has gone down. So now, going into the future, what's the Fed doing or going to do next, I think will remain a very, very important question. And, you know, it'd be like 10,000 economists all gazing at some small animal and trying to guess what it's going to do. Sorry, it's Friday afternoon after a very long week.
Yeah, the financial groundhog.
Yes, thank you. That'd be what it was.
Yeah. Gold, silver, and copper prices have been flying. Can you give us a brief metals report?
I can. Everybody, I think, has been certainly focused on gold, and we've talked about gold a lot, and it seems to be maybe the most important metal from an investment point of view, if not from an industrial application point of view. So gold this week closed the week with a new all-time high daily and weekly close. I think we were around, we were over $2,400 U.S. And I think we have new all-time highs in most of the other currencies as well. Gold's been on a tear here. I mean, I think the last time we talked, I discussed Chinese retail buying seemed to kind of present the cherry on top of the great run that we'd had. And markets did back away in the last month here. I don't know. I think we dropped maybe $150 from the previous all-time highs of about a month ago, and we've recovered that and more. The daily swings in the price of all of the metals has been greater than I've seen for many years. Silver prices here have had just a terrific run this past week or more, but it's been building. We did hit an 11-year high in silver, around $31 this week. That's an increase of about 40% from the lows in February, and I think we're up 20% in just the last 3 weeks. So the pattern in silver has been similar to gold, as you would expect. It's just, the pattern and the silver prices are just much more dramatic in their swings up and down. For me, the copper market has been amazing. It almost looks like the cocoa market, but not quite. We have soared, this is U.S. prices anyway, to all-time highs in copper above $5 a pound, ending Friday of this week. That is up about 14% so far this month, and I don't know how far we in just 3 weeks or so into this week, into the month. And I think it's almost a 40% gain in the last 3 months. And that's copper the metal. The copper mining shares have probably outperformed copper in some respects, at least in the degree that they've risen so sharply in this year. One of the favorite copper ETFs is called COPEX, C-O-P-X, and I see it's at a 13-year high. The gold mining shares, I should mention, have also kind of got woken up. There was a time here, well, almost any time actually, over the last 10 years, where you could say that gold shares or the shares of gold mining companies just continued to underperform gold. And, that disappointed some people who, instead of buying bullion or something, bought shares. So it has been a very strong market, and other base metals as well are doing great. But I do have to share this little story with you. I see that, well, let me back it up and say the underlying reason, I laugh when I say that. The underlying reason why copper prices have been going up is because of the electrification of everything, and we're going to need more copper to wires to do this and that and the other thing, and it's difficult to find any new copper mines, let alone, you know, get them permitted, get to raise the money to get them going and bring them into production. So you just had this fabulous imbalance in the supply-demand story in copper. So I saw this little story this week where thieves are focusing on ripping off the cables that are at the EV charging places. And now, why would they do that? Well, when you have a look at the cable that they connect the charging unit, you know, to your car, the thing is just basically solid copper with a rubber wire wrapping around the outside. And it's really easy to steal. So there's some irony, I think, in the fact that people buying EVs because, you know, they want to be environmental or whatever reasons they have for that. And, you know, that's the thought that there'd be more and more of that happening has caused the price of copper to run up to the extent that thieves are now going to make it impossible for you to drive up to a charging place and charge your car. As I say, yeah, it's just my sick sense of humor, I suppose, to think that there's some irony in that.
Well, the amount of copper in an electric vehicle is astounding. 277% more than your ICE vehicle. 183 pounds of copper or 83 kilograms.
There you go. So yeah. Anyway, but here's the thing. I suppose I should touch on this. I pay very close attention to what we call commitments of traders reports, and that comes out once a week, and it shows us basically who's doing what in the market. Now, not individual names, but we would say that speculators or non-commercial accounts, and they can be small speculators like you or I or the mammoth corporations or anybody in between, speculators are really, really, really bullish and long in the copper market. Okay, and it's been that way and getting more so that way as prices have run up. And for me to, say, step in and buy copper right here, right now, would be just way too risky for the way I trade because I need to know where I would get out if the copper market, you know, had a correction. And at this point, you know, it could easily correct far more than I'd be willing to risk to protect my account. So I think we have, you know, the RSI, Relative Strength Index, is off the charts and everything else, as you could imagine. Somewhat similar, I think, with silver, maybe less so with gold. The speculators, you know, are in a FOMO-driven mode here. They don't want to miss a thing, so they bid the market up aggressively. Yes, there's been a good reason, a hell of a story on the supply-demand side, particularly in copper. But, you know, the dynamics of who's bought when and all that kind of thing make it pretty risky right here.
The leading stock indices have been making new highs after a three-week sell-off in April. What's driving share prices higher?
Well, let's see. A number of things. Certainly, we've just gone through the quarterly reporting time period where the major companies listed on the exchanges give a quarterly report to say, here's what we did and here's what we think's, you know, coming down the pipe. And those quarterly reports, of course, I don't want to be too cynical, but let's say they're choreographed, and so that, you know, they do look good. And on balance, the corporations are looking ahead and thinking that things are going to be fine and going to continue to do their business and make money. I think the price earnings ratios that we're seeing, you know, across the board with the different stocks are very high right here, right now. The earnings have been good and people are paying up on the expectation that earnings will not only continue to be good, but will get better. I think we could see, corporations generically, try to cut costs to maintain strong earnings. That might lead to some layoffs. But one of the side effects is that the corporations are very aggressively buying back their own shares. We had Apple, when they had their quarterly report couple of weeks ago said, you know, they'll be buying back $100 billion worth of their stock this year. But what we're seeing on average, there's a little better than $5 billion a day of share buybacks of the major companies listed in the S&P 500. You know, that creates a pretty good floor. What else is driving this market higher besides earnings and buybacks and, you know, earning outlook is strong? We have momentum here, and momentum, I think, is coming from many things, but I think there is a feeling out there at the retail level, at least, that we got to get into this market. You know, it's kind of like the real estate market of a few years ago where, you know, you just, things are going up, you know, you don't want to be left behind Charlie. So we call that FOMO, but I mean, it's real. There's, you know, money, we track the capital flows, and money just keeps flowing into the stock market. We had the Dow Jones hit 40,000 this week. I think it was Thursday or Friday. I mean, I remember trading when the Dow was under 1,000. You know, and here we are at 40,000. And actually, I've got the numbers, and I'm going to put those in my trading desk notes this week as to when the Dow is at 1,000, when it hit 5, when it hit 10, when it hit 20, 30, and so on. And here we are at 40. But that's an amazing benchmark, you know, from where we were just, you know, 20 years ago or something like that. Actually, in reference to that, let me do a segue. My last trading desk notes, I quoted my good friend Martin Mirenbeeld, who is a world-class gold analyst, and he was talking about how the divergence from the regular historical relationship between gold and interest rates and the U.S. dollar, and he was saying, it's a new world. It is different. And I've written many times something to the same effect that, you know, what do they used to say? This isn't your father's Oldsmobile. Well, it's not your father's market, or certainly not your grandfather's market anymore. We're in different times, and some of the old ways or old school ways of looking at or trying to evaluate markets, I think, are being thrown out the window. It's not so much it's a brave new world, because there is always going to be mean reversion, but between now and the time things mean revert to where you think they should be, you could really lose your shirt if you bet the wrong way.
The U.S. dollar index rose about 6% from December to April, but fell in the last 3 weeks. What are your thoughts on the currency markets?
I think the currency markets since December in particular have been, and that's when the U.S. dollar made it slow, I think, for last year, and then we've definitely done better since then, as you just noted. I think the U.S. dollar did better on balance because markets thought that the Fed would keep interest rates higher for longer than other central banks. And I know that sounds horribly simple, but interest rates, or relative interest rates, are just hugely important in the currency markets. Now, we had, on top of that, for instance, the Swiss franc, which was last December, I think the Swiss franc made an all-time high against the U.S. dollar and also against the euro. I think the Swiss authorities wanted to get the Swiss franc down, and they've been one of the central banks that has cut rates, you know, vis-a-vis the Americans talking about keeping rates higher for longer. The Swiss actually cut rates. The Japanese yen had been trending down for years, and it, you know, in April, I guess, made something like 34 years lows against the U.S. dollar. I think what I just said a few minutes ago about the idea that the Fed's going to stay higher for longer has caused the U.S. dollar to weaken here the past couple of weeks. As, say, the stock market has gone up and the bond market has gone up, the U.S. dollar has gone down, and I think that's part of it. Where we go from here will certainly depend on what the different central banks do, but I'll go to positioning again, just like I did in copper. The market is very, very bullish and very, very long on the U.S. dollar against other currencies. Now, not everything across the board. And the most important cross rate in the FX market is the euro dollar, US dollar I should say, the euro-US dollar cross rate, and that's about flat. But the market is hugely short of Japanese yen, Swiss francs, Canadian dollars, Australian dollars. And just by the way, to put it the other way around, the market's very long the Mexican peso against the U.S. dollar. And one of the reasons for that is peso short-term interest rates are around 11%. American short rates are at 5%. So, you know, you park your money in Mexican pesos and it goes up. Well, you make the difference on the interest rate spread as well as the currency gain. So, again, interest rates are hugely important with currencies. And I think as we go forward from here, the market is taking, or at least pricing in, the notion here that the difference between the different central banks won't be so great, and the positioning is leaving us vulnerable to the U.S. dollar weakening because speculators have been buying it so aggressively and would have to cover. So that's the way I look at the currency markets right now. In other words, if I needed to put a trade on right now in the currency market, I'd be looking to be short the U.S. dollar against some of the currencies that are where traders or speculators are most aggressively short.
Is there any hope for the Japanese yen with Japan's very, very low interest rates?
Short answer would be no, but of course there is. And one of the reasons there, we did have the Japanese authorities come in, and I say that. You know, they haven't publicly announced that they did, but everybody that's trading the market knows that they were there. They have a lot of U.S. dollars, and they put about 60 billion of them into the market to buy the yen to keep it from getting weaker. So they've kind of put a line in the sand, as it were. Now, if their economy continued to be sluggish, and they had other problems, then, you know, the market will just probably take the yen to new lows. But it won't be without a fight, I think, from the authorities. And if, in fact, the U.S. dollar is weakening, as it is against some other currencies, then the massive, massive short position in Japanese yen, folks might start to say, well, you know, we've made a hell of a lot of money in this position. Why don't we take some of that off the table, or why don't we just close the position out and do other things? And so that kind of creates a floor for the Japanese yen.
Crude oil prices have gone sideways over the last 3 weeks, but natural gas prices have jumped. What do you see ahead for the energy markets?
Yeah, crude oil has been kind of quiet. I guess we came down about $10 a barrel from our highs, and I think the coming down reflected a lessening, if you can imagine, of geopolitical stress, especially, you know, most of that decline of $10 or so happened after a rather low-key tit-for-tat between Iran and Israel. When that started, you know, people, I think with good reason, were holding their breath and thought, okay, if Israel and Iran are going to go head-to-head, this could spin out of control in no time. So we had then some kind of a risk premium bid in the crude oil market for that reason alone. You know, if Iran and Israel are having an all-out war, then there's going to be less crude oil coming out of the Middle East, less crude oil from anywhere, because, you know, there's going to be transportation vehicles transporting ships transporting the crude oil are going to not be able to maneuver. Since that, I'll call it mild tit for tat, the risk premium has gone down. So maybe it has gone down $10. So these are kind of amorphous things to guess how much is really there. But I think that's been part of the reason for the decline. Crude prices have gone kind of sideways here, you know, in the high 70s, let's say between 77 and 80 bucks a barrel on WTI. I think maybe just finding their footing as to where they go next. Natural gas, you say, has jumped. I think it's jumped actually, you know, in the nature of 40%, but it's jumped from what I've been describing, I think, not only on my website, but also on your show, from incredibly low levels. I mean, on an inflation-adjusted basis, it was at zero. I mean, it was just dirt cheap. So, yeah, we've had a perk up. We're going into the summer air conditioning season with demand there. There may be some other factors. Of course, there would be other factors in play, like whether or not they're going to be able to get permits to export more LNG out of the states and so on. But, yeah, crude oil and natural gas, even though, you know, in a way they come out of the same spot in the ground almost, are not tied together. So we can have crude oil kind of down and going sideways and a big jump in natural gas. You know, in terms of the broader question, what's ahead for energy? I would think that the simple answer is the world's going to need more. We're going to consume more. It's just a matter of, you know, whether or not you can get stuff to where it's needed and whether or not people got the money to pay for it.
In your weekly trading desk notes, you say you make money by managing risk, not by having a great crystal ball. What do you mean by that?
You know, I think I say that because I fear that my listeners may assume that some people just know what's going to happen. You know, like they have a crystal ball. And some of the market analysts, and if I could just put that in quotes, some of the market analysts that I see out there kind of, you know, they sort of, from my point of view, pretend they do have a crystal ball. You know, they got it figured out. And they're going to tell you exactly what you should do to get rich. And if so long as you pay them the fees they want and all that sort of thing. Nobody knows what's going to happen is my view on things. And anybody who says he does is either naive or delusional or any combination of that or just an outright liar. There are so many, many, many variables that are affecting things that are kind of known. And then, of course, you get your proverbial black swans and all that sort of thing. But I think maybe I just popped it in my head right now. You have described when you introduced me that I was in the brokerage business for, it was about 45 years. And during that period of time, particularly as a commodities broker, I did see what I describe as hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lose millions and millions and millions of dollars. And I thought, is there something that they have in common? And I thought, yes, they hate to take losses. You know, I don't know how many times over my career I heard people say to me or, you know, say to the brokers that worked with me, oh, well, let's just give it a couple more days. I'm sure it's going to turn around, you know. And I thought, well, if all of those people, that's what they do in common. If I don't do that, maybe that increases my odds of coming out money ahead. And it seems to. So, as I said earlier when we were talking, about copper. I couldn't buy copper here. I mean, I could believe the story, and that's another thing. People get these ideas and believe stories, but I could believe that the supply-demand story in copper is very bullish. But that doesn't mean that now, at this price, is the right time to get in. And to just to be able to say, you know, I'll pass. I won't do anything. I won't. Yeah, it's a great story, but no, I won't buy any. Just to be able to resist doing something because you heard a story and you think you're the first guy that heard the story. Anyhow, managing risk is key to actually making money. I lose money on more of the trades that I make than I make money on. And that'll vary over time, but let's say certainly on average over the last 20 years or something like that, more than 50% of the trades that I make lose money. And I keep my losses small. The thing in all of my trading, not only for just protecting my capital in my account, but my mental health, is I just never, ever want to take a big loss. So I don't. And I sleep better that way, and it's just, you know, it's just a job. Now, I don't like losing money, but that's just, you know, what can I say? It's like when you sit down at a poker table, I guess, and you put an ante in, you know. Even if you don't do anything, you're going to lose that. And that's just kind of the way I look at it. You got to pay some money to be in the game, but you don't have to pay a lot of money to stay in the game if you don't, if you're not holding the right cards.
Victor, thank you so much for being on the show.
Jim, it is always a pleasure. I look forward to this, and I know I maybe ramble on a little bit, but I think maybe I'm just kind of hoping that your listeners want to know, well, what do you really think?
Well, I've heard what you really think, and it's still pretty good.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Victor Adair, retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business, but he's still very active in the markets. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from Parksville, British Columbia. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclical, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. You can find him on Substack at rubino.substack.com. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hey, Jim. Hope everything is going well up there.
Everything's terrific, of course. Is the Fed signaling that it will accept 3% inflation?
You know, it sounds like, because the inflation numbers have been coming out this week in the U.S., and we're, you know, 3% or a little plus going forward. And, the Fed's not freaking out about it. The implication is, and the expectation is now, that they're going to cut maybe in September. So not that far into the future. And they're going to do it with inflation at 3 or 4%, you know. So that the implication then is that they're accepting it. And if they do, then, you know, we're just going to have to talk about how similar all of this is to the 1970s more and expect higher inflation. Once they've given up on the 2% thing, there's no reason why they can't give up on 3 or 4. So we will see. But it's an ominous sign for the currencies and a phenomenal sign for precious metals.
Well, if we're going back to the 70s, that means platform shoes, bell-bottom pants, disco.
does her wife still? Does your wife still have her mini skirts?
She looks good in mini skirts. She's got great legs.
Well, then a replay of the '70s will be no problem for you at all.
Mortgage rates are back above 7% in the U.S. Are we in higher for longer till something breaks territory?
Yeah, if the Fed's not going to cut and mortgage rates are above 7%, that creates a lot of stress out there in different sectors. One is obviously real estate, because house prices, in some places they're down a bit, but in a lot of other places they're not, which means that the house you would have bought, say, 3 or 4 years ago with a 3% mortgage, now, if you buy it with a 7% mortgage, it costs you twice as much per month to own that same house. And houses were already unaffordable in the U.S. and Canada, at least, before the pandemic. So, yeah, I think if we keep interest rates at this level, mortgage rates stay at this level, it basically snuffs out a big chunk of the housing market, other than Wall Street firms coming in and buying whole neighborhoods. There won't be a lot of individuals who need to take out a mortgage buying houses in the future. And then commercial real estate is already in the process of being crushed by today's interest rates, which in turn means the local and regional banks are in grave danger. So yeah, higher for longer till something breaks is a very good description of today's world.
Low-end retailers like Walmart and McDonald's are reporting weak demand. Is that a sign consumers are tapped out?
Well, yeah, as far as that goes, it is. And Walmart just announced another interesting part of this, where they had great earnings. But it was because middle-of-the-road shoppers who might shop at higher-end stores are trading down to Walmart, so says Walmart, because middle-class people are having trouble making ends meet now, too. So they're having to cut back in various ways. And one of them is they stop shopping at high-end outlets and start shopping at Walmart. So that's another sign of societal weakness, even though it looks good for Walmart's numbers in the short run. So, yeah, I definitely think that there's a dynamic now where people have spent their stimmy checks and the other money that they saved during the pandemic. Now they're putting day-to-day life on credit cards because of the most recent inflation, which increased their cost of living by 30%. Or they're doing buy now, pay later, or they're looking at taking out home equity lines of credit. They're doing things that a financially healthy family probably wouldn't do. All that's happening, and all of that signals a slowdown in the next couple of years. It could be pretty dramatic. So combine, you know, Walmart with all this other stuff. And even though a recession hasn't started yet, and it really should have by now, it's going to start pretty soon, I think.
Japan's interest rates are rising while the yen is falling. Is a death spiral beginning for them?
Yeah, Japan is a good example of where we're headed in the U.S. and possibly Canada. They had their big credit crisis in the 1990s and decided to quote-unquote fix it with big government deficits used to bail out all the zombie companies that would have gone bankrupt if they'd been allowed to. And that has never ended. The government is racking up bigger and bigger debts, and they've been able to do that as long as they have by keeping interest rates at artificially low rates. But now the yen is falling and interest rates are rising in Japan, and they cannot fix both of those problems. They have to choose one or the other, and that's where it gets interesting, because either one, I mean, if you let the currency collapse, that's a catastrophe. If you let interest rates go up in an indebted system, then the interest costs eat you alive. They have to choose one. And so do we in the not-too-distant future. And either way, it's a mess. It's just our choice of messes.
Gold seems to have stabilized in the 2300s. What does this mean for gold miner earnings?
Well, you know, you and I and lots of other people have been talking for what seems like years now about how, you know, gold at 2000 ought to be good for the miners. And then the stocks of the best run gold miners ought to be outperforming gold. And that didn't happen. The gold miners stayed really depressed until gold got to around 2300, where it's now kind of stabilized. I think it's like 2370 today in the U.S. And the miners are starting to respond. And the reason for this is largely because at that price, the miners are selling their product at a pretty good profit margin. You know, they're able to make money and generate free cash flow with gold in the 2300s. And that means they're going to be able to do all the good things that a company could do with free cash flow. They can raise their dividends, they can buy back their own stock, and they can go out and make acquisitions. You know, the acquisition part isn't good for the big miners, but it's good for the smaller guys. So there's a reason to like precious metals miners now, no matter what sector you're more interested in. And it's starting to show up in the charts. You've seen a lot of gold miners. I think which ones did I post? I posted Pan American Silver and Agnico Eagle charts in a recent Substack, and they both look great. You know, they're up, and then straight up. That's what their charts look like. So I think we're going to see more of that out there. Now, did we talk about silver today, Jim? I can't remember.
Yes, yes, we have silver on the lineup here, John.
Okay, good, because that's an interesting tie-in.
Yeah, the silver deficit's into its fourth year. If that continues, will the world run out of silver?
Yeah, That an analyst just came out lately and said yes to that question in 2 years. So to set up the story, we're using more silver than the world's mines are producing right now. And a big part of that is solar panels. But there's also a lot of other industrial and military uses. Most of U.S. missiles use a lot of silver. And the electrification of the world, like electric cars and all the wiring that's required for the chargers and stuff like that, that involves some silver too. So we're using up silver that may not get recycled in the future. And so the question is, how much longer are we going to be able to draw on existing inventories to make up the deficit? And if we can't, does the deficit turn into a shortage, which spikes prices and causes all kinds of turmoil out there? And like I said, there's an analyst out there who, big name bank, just came out and said 18 to 24 months is all the silver that we have left. So that's a huge part of the silver story, if that's the case. And I'm looking at a chart of silver right now, and you can go back 5 years, and resistance was $27 an ounce in the U.S. And silver just blew through that in the last month. It's $29.90. I think on CNBC, that's the one month futures contract. Okay, so spot is a little below that, but still, you can assume that $30 a share is serious resistance, because it's not a nice round number, and all the people who've been buying silver for years and have been underwater for all this time, they're going to feel like they want to take a little bit of a profit. So expect a lot of resistance at silver or at 30, but when it pierces 30, which it is going to do one of these days, then it's wide open. You know, it could run to 35 with no real resistance. And then if it breaks through 35, it's 50, you know? So I think this is an exciting time for silver. Again, very similar to the 1970s and to the 2000s. Where silver languished for a long time, then inflation started to become undeniable, and silver just went parabolic. So both of those previous times it hit $50 an ounce. And I think that would be a disappointment if it only hits $50 an ounce this time around. Mm.
Yeah, I remember the 70s. The Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market. And still burned in my mind is the image of these two really fat guys riding mini bikes into the distance saying they plan to take silver with them. And, yeah. Of course, dentists started charging more for your fillings because of the silver, but when the prices came down, the dentists didn't lower their prices. That's the problem with inflation. People get used to paying those higher prices. One of my questions was, why don't governments mandate solar panels on the south side of all new buildings? Wouldn't that help ease the electrical shortages expected due to EVs, AI, and crypto mining?
I think they either did that or they were considering doing that in California, where if you build a new house, it's got to have some solar panels on the roof. And see, solar is only appropriate for certain places. As Germany found out, you can't just slap solar panel farms in any field in a cloudy, cool country and expect to generate enough electricity to make it worthwhile. So, the U.S., of course, half the country qualifies for solar because you get down below the Mason-Dixon line and it's really sunny here. California could do it. Arizona could do it. I'm not sure people need a lot of incentive to do it in sunny places, though. So it might not be the kind of thing that that causes that much of a difference, just because it's already kind of an attractive thing to do if you're building a house in Atlanta or Miami or someplace, because you get enough sun to give it a quick payback period. So I think nuclear is more of a story as far as the electrification of the world goes, because rooftop solar is kind of already pretty well understood and homeowners get it. I think most homeowners at one time or another have looked into solar to see if it was viable where they are. And if the answer comes back yes, then it's kind of a no-brainer because it gives you free utilities for as far as the eye can see. And who doesn't want that? But I think solar is part of the solution, but nuclear is a much bigger part of the solution. We've got to set up more nuclear power. and then see if using the downtime to generate hydrogen is as interesting as it looks, you know, and that's the course that that the U.S. is going very slowly at. Some other countries are getting into nuclear in a much quicker pace, but I still think that you know, solar is a big deal for silver, and it's basically baked into the cake that we're going to have growth in solar demand going forward with peaks and valleys. You know, you have booms and busts and something that's kind of like a microchip the way solar is. But the idea of using nuclear to get us through this transition is very appealing. And then, you know, you're still going to need solar for all the end products, for instance, the electric cars. Assuming electric cars work out, I think there's another, it's more speculative, but it's very interesting part of the silver story. And that is that they're working on some new fuel cells that replace platinum the part of the fuel cell. But anyhow, they're replacing platinum with silver. Silver is much cheaper than platinum, so it lowers the cost of the fuel cells. And so you can have nuclear power produce hydrogen, which runs fuel cells in a possibly cheaper but much, much cleaner environmental way than we're doing now with lithium-ion batteries. And then, you know, if these fuel cells use silver, that's going to be a gigantic new component of silver demand. And I think that's a few years out, but it, you know, here's the best case scenario for silver is that we get into the shortage part of the process. Silver starts going up because of that. And then these new fuel cells come online and add to the shortage in a really dramatic way. And then silver just goes parabolic because at that point, its only limit is the price of platinum, right? And, you know, if it goes up to above platinum's price, then platinum will be used again for fuel cells. But until that point, silver, at least in that segment of its market, can keep on going up. So exciting but speculative idea for the future.
Is it concerning or disturbing that places like Mexico are considering open pit bans? They're one of the world's biggest silver producers, aren't they?
Yeah, see, that's concerning for the miners, right? So if you've got mining stocks and some of those companies have open pit mines in Mexico, you need to be watching that. But it's excellent for silver. If you've got physical silver and Mexico closes down a bunch of its silver mines, that just makes the price of silver go up even more, right? It limits demand and increases the shortage that we're seeing out there. So I have mixed feelings about what Mexico is doing right now because I have way too much physical silver. And this would vindicate my obsession with stacking if that happened.
Well, you've always been kind of what I would call a silver bug, or is it because you're just fascinated with the metal and its potential?
I like shiny things, first of all. So it's kind of a magpie thing going. And, you know, I'm definitely a gold bug, but in the precious metal market, you know, with the scenarios that people in the gold bug community believe in, which I definitely believe in, silver is the volatile little tech stock kind of thing in that space where gold is big and solid and it's going to go in the right direction, but it's, you know, a multi-trillion dollar market and it's not going to go straight up for very long. Silver, on the other hand, is a tiny market, relatively speaking, that is still needed for industrial uses. It's not just a monetary metal. So it's got two drivers of its price increases. And it's so thinly traded that it can go straight up. So silver is the equivalent of a 10-bagger junior mining stock, and gold is the equivalent of a major like Newmont or Agnico Eagle or something like that. Both good to own, But the more speculative you are, the more appealing silver is. And I tend to be somebody who's obsessive about an idea. You know, I decide I know what's going to happen, and then I'm compelled to bet the farm on that thing happening. So no normal person should do that, but I do that. And it looks like it might be working out. So this is a very exciting time.
John, anything else you think we should be keeping a super close eye on right now?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of things going on in the world that we need to be watching right now, and geopolitics is a big one. There are two wars going on in the world right now, and potentially three or four. If you count the U.S. versus Iran as a separate war from what's happening in Israel right now, there's three right there. And apparently we've got boots on the ground in Ukraine right now, and we're talking about naval engagements with China, and it just goes on and on. So that's vastly more important if the worst case scenario happens in geopolitics right now than anything financial. We can get through a financial crisis with no trouble. At least people who are paying attention can do that. But, you know, shooting wars with nuclear powers, all bets are off. And so here's hoping and praying that that part of the dark gloom and doom world that it's easy to envision never happens. And that the only gloom and doom stuff for the next few years is currency collapses and spiking precious metals and bank collapses and things like that. Those are all things we can manage and we can get through. Just don't drop nuclear weapons on my kids. That's all I'm asking.
What worries me is world leaders, you know, in their 80s or near their 80s, hey, their lifespan is just about up. So what have they personally got to lose by using nukes? That worries me.
That's a real thing because, you know, you can get disoriented in your old age and really despairing. You'll see your life slipping away and you'll think, screw it, I'm going to take everybody else with me.
Yeah.
If somehow you've been elected to office or you're the dictator of a nuclear power or something like that, you know, and nobody who was deciding whether to put you in power or not saw that in you. So, yeah, completely possible. And there are also religions that are very apocalyptic out there, too, where, you know, part of their prophecy is the world is ending in the not-too-distant future. And how the world ends is not all that important. It's just important that, you know, there's fire and brimstone. And if they can bring it about, they might actually think they're going to heaven by doing it.
John, thank you so much for talking with us. Where's the best place for people to follow you?
Thanks, Jim. I'm at rubino.substack.com.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com, and you just heard the best place to find him on Substack at rubino.substack.com. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.